Welcome to the Always Better Than Yesterday podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Hartley. This podcast exists to equip and inspire your heart-centered leadership. Every week, we bring interviews with some of the greatest heart sets and mindsets on the planet. I hope the heartprint of our time spent together is that it creates new possibilities for you and all those you come into contact with. If you'd like to explore what we could make possible for you, then head to abty.co.uk/connect and book in a free 30-minute call to begin our journey. On episode 256, what an honour it is to welcome Patrick Lencioni to the podcast. Patrick is all about helping teams become more cohesive, effective and successful. His organisation, The Table Group, is a firm dedicated to making organisations healthier and work more dignifying. Pat has written 13 best-selling books on the topics of teamwork, leadership and culture, including The 5 Dysfunctions of a Team, The Advantage, The Ideal Team Player and The Motive. In 2020, Pat began to question why he occasionally felt drained and frustrated in his own job, something I know many of you have and are experiencing. In the process of figuring out why, Working Genius was born. Since that time, Working Genius has helped hundreds of thousands of individuals and teams discover their gifts and transform their work. The 6 types of Working Genius is a model that helps people discover their natural gifts and thrive in their work and life. It identifies the 6 fundamental activities that are required for any type of work and provides a simple framework for how work gets done. It's changing the way people are thinking about their work and teams and is leading to more dignified, fulfilled and successful work. Pat and I have an incredible conversation about leadership, all things Working Genius, and you can take your assessment using the link in the show notes. Here we go. It's episode 256 with Patrick Lencioni. Patrick Lencioni, welcome to the Always Better Than Yesterday podcast. How are you, brother?
I'm doing well. It's good to be on with you. I wish I were over there right now with you at nighttime in England. That sounds fun.
Well, we were just having a little chat when you really want to be down on the coast where they're recording or Doc Martin.
Yeah, I'm totally into Doc Martin. I'm like on season 6 right now, and it's great. It's great.
Yeah, I'm so grateful that we're having this conversation. I first came across your legendary work when I used to work in the UK Police Service. So I was working in the corporate development part of the world, and we were trained as internal leadership consultants, and the 5 dysfunctions of a team was this incredible model that everyone was raving about, talking about. And so fast forward 6 years, you know, after leaving the police and sitting here having this conversation with you, it's a little bit surreal. So just want to appreciate you, and I really want to acknowledge the fact that of all of your great work, 5 Dysfunctions, The Motive, it was Getting Naked that had the most impact on me, because I'd left the policing and went into my own kind of consulting world. And just some of the things that you put in, because I came from a public sector background, you know, my mindset was very limited to how things worked. I didn't really know much about the business world. And just to hear do you know what? The single greatest takeaway was probably go and serve people. Just go with a pad and a pen and go and start solving some problems. I was like, I so needed to hear that at that point.
That's great. I loved writing that book. It was interesting because that's the first book I wrote, which was really about how we do what we do rather than what we do.
Yeah.
And it was the first book that I ever wrote in the first person. You know, most books I'm writing about, and I wrote it as though I was the main character, and I got to have more fun with that and bring a little bit more humor into it. It was a really fun book to write. And so in some ways, it's a little special favorite of mine, I think.
I don't want to assume that everybody is familiar with all of your work. I'd love to make space for who is Pat. Tell us about Pat, The Table Group, and the great work that you do in the world.
Oh, man, where to begin? I'll try to go fast. I'm big on going fast. I think that I didn't go to college. I mean, I went to college. My family didn't go to college, so it was all new to me. I got a job that was supposed to be the best job in the world at a company called Bain & Company. You might be familiar with it. They've been in London forever too. And I didn't like it very much because we were working with companies and it was all about data and about finance and strategy and all the, which are very interesting. But I was like, these companies, there's something else going on here and I don't get it. It's not this. And it was like human issues. There was politics and they didn't get along and they weren't aligned and all this stuff. And I was young, but the people said, hey, they don't pay us to solve those problems. So just keep keep crunching the numbers. And I remember thinking, that's what I want to do someday. I'm really fascinated by the human dimension of business because I think all of the other stuff doesn't work if there's problems in the human dimension. But since it's hard to measure, people kind of avoid it. So slowly I moved my career by the grace of God into this field. And I was, you know, 5 years into a tenure, I was an executive at a software company. And I had this wonderful team around me. And I said, I think I should just go start my own firm and do this. And my dad, God rest his soul, is like, no, you have benefits. You have a business card that says vice president. But we launched it. And we thought, Ryan, that all we were going to do is for the next 30 years is just be a consultant, drive around and help companies. And then we started doing that. And then I wrote a book kind of by accident. I didn't think it would get published. It got published. And somebody said, you should give a speech about that. You should write another book. The next thing we knew, we had all these books that people were reading, and I was getting called to speak as well as consult. And the firm just kind of grew from there. And so the footprint of the Table Group is much bigger than the number of people that work here. And really, by the grace of God, a lot of people are using our stuff in a way that we had never, could never have imagined. I did not know when I wrote The Five Dysfunctions of a Team that somebody that worked in the police in the UK would be using it. No less a basketball team in the Philippines and soldiers in Afghanistan and churches all over the place. Many organizations were using it, and we did not even think about that.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think it just caught?
You know what I think it is? I think that I like to say to people that I am really, if I became a saint, I'd be the saint of the ignorant. What I mean by that is I have a real passion for explaining things to people who I think probably like they've heard it, but they don't get it. And I'm not embarrassed to say, hey, let me make it simpler for you. I remember once when I worked in a company, Ryan, I was in this technology company, and I didn't really understand what the technology did, but I worked in leadership development and I met all these other people. And I suddenly really realized most of the people here don't even know what our technology does. So I put together a class to explain technology to non-technical people. And to do it, and the people that went to it loved it. They were like, I had no idea. But to do it, Ryan, I went and sat down with some engineers. I said, okay, pretend I'm a 10-year-old and you have to explain this to me. I finally got to the place where I was like, okay, pretend I'm three, literally a 3-year-old. How would you explain it? And then they explained it. I got it. And I actually could explain it to others. So I'm really big into simplifying things that are unnecessarily complex so that real people like me can understand it and put it into practice. And I have no delusions of being like super sophisticated and smarter than the average bear. I just try to explain it to people in a way they can hear it.
No, that's fair. And I think you're the first person I really remember hearing describe trust as a vulnerability-based trust. For people that haven't necessarily listened to Dysfunctions of a Team, definitely go and check it out. You know, there's, I think you deliver a TED talk on it as well. And it's very, very powerful because I think what you do is you speak into the feeling that most people have about this, I can't be vulnerable at work. It's this feeling of tension and risk and uncertainty. Would you speak into that for us? What do you mean by vulnerability-based trust?
Yeah, it's interesting you hit on that, Ryan, because this may be the single most important thing. It's the heart of everything we talk about, and that is this. Without trust, a team, an organization, any endeavor doesn't work. A relationship doesn't work. Trust is key. And people think, yeah, that's obvious. But when I talk about trust, a lot of people think trust means I've known you for many years, Ryan, so I can predict your behavior. I can trust what you will do. That's predictive trust.
Yeah,
that does not make a team great. And that takes years, and even still, it's missing something. The most important kind of trust is when two human beings or a group of human beings can be completely open with one another, vulnerable about their strengths, weaknesses, mistakes they've made, lack of intelligence or insight into an issue. They can be completely naked, as we like to say. And you know what's the funny thing is? Do you know what the word vulnerability comes from? The root in Latin is vulna, is wound. Is wound. And we have to be comfortable with our wounds and not protecting ourselves. And it's counterintuitive. It's countercultural. People are like, no, protect yourself. And to be vulnerable to another person says, I'm going to open myself to being wounded and potentially hurt by you in order to develop a stronger relationship. And it's so powerful. And teams that do it outperform teams that don't. It's just true.
Yeah. And you know, so often for the leader to go first, because you know, there's no algorithm that says it's 75% safe to be vulnerable right now. It's beyond the intellect, it's beyond the mind, and therefore it's courage. And, you know, if we're going with the root of words, courage is cur, which is heart.
Yes, heart. Exactly. It's so funny. I do another podcast. I'll tell it to your team because it's for leaders and it's about faith.
Yeah.
And it's called the 3 minute. Are you familiar with this?
Nope. Go ahead.
So every morning on weekday mornings, I do a 3 minute podcast called the 3 minute reset. And the one I listened to today, cause I go back and listen, was about courage, and it comes from the Latin for heart. So the fact that you just said that. So for, if you're a faith leader or in the professional world, and you'd like to begin your day with just like a thought about how your faith impacts your work, that we do that. It's called the 3 minute reset. So
yeah, I love that. That's just so powerful. And you know, I think the absence of that is, and we're going to get to the big body of work that I'm really excited to hear about in a minute, but about authenticity, right? If you haven't got that vulnerability, you don't really get the comfort to show up authentically, which means that so many people are in workplaces hiding parts of themselves. They're not fully expressed, cutting off parts. So that can't not have an impact both within the team and within the human spirit.
Absolutely. In fact, if there's no such thing as inauthentically vulnerable, right? Because that is, think about that. That is like, I'm pretending, I'm showing you things that aren't necessarily true
in order
to get an impact. Vulnerability by its very nature is I'm giving up control and safety.
Yeah.
Which is why you shouldn't do it to a stranger on the street.
Right.
But when you're in a family or a relationship or a team,
yeah,
you say, let's build vulnerability together in a way that it's always risky, but that will lead to something really good.
Yeah. I must take away some of the most quirkiest insights from your books, but with the five dysfunctions, one of the things I've taken away, and I say this to my wife all the time, is that good teams don't have an absence of conflict. They get stronger through the conflict. So your model has helped me justify many an argument, Patrick. Thank you.
And it's
because
true,
we come through it more committed.
Yes. Now it's all predicated on trust.
Yes.
You start there. But if you trust another person, if you implicitly trust that they are willing to be vulnerable, which means they're going to say, oh, you're right, I'm wrong, or I didn't know that, or I made a mistake, or I'm sorry, I've been a jerk today. If you know that you have that trust with them, why in the world would you not engage in an argument? Because you know that the only reason you're doing it is to find the truth.
Yeah.
There's no risk. Even though in the moment, even with your spouse, I've been married for almost 32 years. And I still don't love to argue with my wife, but I know that it's going to end with a clearer understanding and a closer relationship because we're going to work through it.
Yeah. Our place in the team's not a threat.
Exactly. Nobody's trying to hurt you or bring you down.
Yeah.
And so I can go there and know that even if I get frustrated and go, I can't believe you don't understand this.
Yeah.
They know that I'm just really hoping that we'll figure out the right answer and that I could apologize after if I went over the line.
Yeah. I mean, people that are familiar with your work know that I'm subtly working through the levels. And my wife and I, we've recently got a second dog. And it's safe to say that I wasn't involved in the decision-making of getting the second dog. So guess what happens when the dog wants to go out at nighttime? It's your dog. I'm not committed. I'm not committed to that decision because I wasn't part of the conflict in decision-making. So no, you're on your own with that one. That's your dog.
You know what's funny? That's so interesting because we have a dog, Freddie. He's 8 years old. Yeah. And my wife wanted to get a dog. She loves dogs. And my kids wanted to get a dog. But we have four boys. And it was hard enough to keep them fed, right? And so I finally said yes. And I said, Laura, I mean this. And I love Freddie. He sleeps next to me in bed. But I said, I'll do it. But I need you to know that the primary responsibility for making sure these things happen is you. That means you can use the boys, you can use others, and I'll help too.
Yeah.
But as long, because I can't commit to that making Freddie more important than the kids and everything else I have. So we had a very clear understanding of that. And now I can do that as a free will gift to her, not feeling like she coerced me into something I didn't want to do.
Yeah. So funny. So much similarity. So there was a 20-year gap between dysfunctions of a team. You could have easily retired. You could have easily just dined out on the celebrity that the dysfunctions of a team's created you. And yet here you are with your most passionate project book that you're putting out with the six types of working genius. Like, where did they come from? Like, what? Tell us the story about how another incredible book emerged from you.
Well, and I don't say this as just a euphemism, but it's the grace of God. I really feel like that, and that I worked for years, and the Five Dysfunctions is the best selling book I've ever done. Others have done really well too, but that's always the book. And when we came up with the six types of working genius, one of the guys that works with me said, this is going to be bigger than than the Five Dysfunctions. And I said, I think so too. And it's proving to be, it's growing so fast, but what it came about by accident. So let me tell you, I was here, I'm in my office right now, but we had a separate office, 'cause we were kind of bursting across the parking lot, a little cottage that we called the innovation cottage, you know? Yeah. And so I was over there and I was doing a podcast. This was 3.5 years ago with a bunch of priests, actually. Yeah. And I was really excited. And then I had to do a debrief meeting with the people that organized that meeting. And I had to give them bad feedback about some of the things they did wrong. And then right after that, I had a meeting where we talked about a new podcast idea. And I went from really excited to really grumpy to really excited. And this woman that worked with me for years, she said, Pat, why are you like that? She just asked the question, and she wasn't being rude. She was like,
such a gift.
Yeah. What? Why does that happen? And I said, I don't know, Amy, but I want to figure it out, because I've been like this for 20 years. I'm working in a company of people I love, doing something I love, and I alternate between grumpy and happy and frustrated and excited, and I want to figure it out. And literally, I don't remember a lot that happened in the next 4 hours, but I know that I had a whiteboard and a pen, and I merged with these six circles. And they were the six kinds of work that are required to get anything done in the world. There's six different kinds of work. And I realized I was living in one that I didn't like. And I was doing it every day and I was burnt out. Well, I just thought I was solving a problem for myself.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking, like, this seems pretty universal. And that very day, Ryan, this one of our consultants actually saw that on my whiteboard. And the next day he was with a client, a CEO of this food company. And the client was talking about how frustrated he was. And this friend and consultant of ours showed it to the client, and he had tears in his eyes. He was like, this explains everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And so within 24 hours of coming up with it, we were like, there's something here.
Yeah.
We need to explore this. And here we are 3 years later, and almost 1 million people have done it, and it's growing like crazy.
And it's kind of backwards to the formula you're normally working with, which is get the book done, send it out, and teach people in the model. But I know that you spent a long period of time building and shaping, which must have done the wonderful thing of you getting to see the impact firsthand before writing the book.
You're exactly right. We'd never done that before. Mm-hmm. And right away, we said, well, we should write a book about this. But a book takes 9 months to write. Mm-hmm. Other months to launch before people do it. Yeah. And we said, no, this is too powerful. Let's do an assessment. And literally 3 months after we came up with the idea, we had an assessment, and the people were taking it like within a week of it and writing back and saying, this has changed my life. I had a husband and wife, and I have you and Lisa's working genius here, who a guy wrote and said, hey, I thought my wife hated me. And he laughed and he goes, I mean it. I kind of thought she hated me, because she, in her genius, would do things that made me feel like she was actually trying to frustrate me, but she was actually trying to help me. And until we did Working Genius, I thought she was against me. And now I realize she was actually loving me in the way she works.
That's so powerful.
It's crazy how many people, one pastor wrote in and said, I've been feeling guilty for 20 years, like I'm a fraud.
Yeah.
And he goes, now that I know my Working Genius, I know I'm just not good at writing a sermon.
Yeah.
But I am really good at counseling people. And I thought, because I couldn't write a sermon, but his geniuses didn't allow him to do that. And it's like, no, we're all different. So anyway, the face validity was off the charts, and it is so much fun. Every person I talk to about their working genius, I'm looking at you and Lisa's right now, and your marriage, I can just imagine what it's like.
All right, before we dive in and just reveal the inner workings of my marriage, because there are definitely moments where she thinks I'm just an asshole. So, which I know is what you've referred to in the book as well, how, you know, the CEO in the parable gets referred to as such with his playful colleagues. But what is a genius? What do you think characterizes a genius?
I'm glad you asked this, because this is so important. It's not what you're good at. It corresponds to what you're good at. Don't get me wrong on that. But it's where you get joy and energy. This is so important. It's like what energizes you and what brings you joy to do. So there's these six geniuses, which we'll talk about in a second. And two of them are what's called your individual working genius. It's the area that you get joy and energy. Now, another two are what's called your working competency, which you can do them for a while, but you don't love it. You don't hate it. It's going to burn you out eventually, but you can do that. Two of them, the remaining two, are your working frustrations. And those, if you have to do them too much, can drive you crazy because they steal your joy and energy.
Soul destroyers. And so,
right. And so knowing what they are is pretty, like I say to people, God gave everybody gifts.
Yes.
But how would you like to get a gift and never unwrap it or never know what it was?
Yeah.
So everybody needs to unwrap their gifts and go, oh yeah, I shouldn't feel guilty for loving that or for being bad at that. I need to realize that's who I am. And it changes everything. The guilt goes away. The judging other people unfairly goes away. Cause now you're looking at them going, oh, you're not lazy.
Yes, you
just don't have tenacity or you're not thick. It's just, I'm asking you to come up with a new idea and you don't have invention. You're still brilliant in your own way, but we tend to think everybody should be everything to all people. And that is a recipe for guilt and frustration.
True. Yeah, very true. With, I love the fact that I go straight to the acknowledgement section of books. I love to get into the heart and the mind of the author. And you acknowledge your son, Matthew. What was so special about Matthew's contribution to the book?
Okay, so he joined the company right after we came up with the idea and we were developing it. We were like, are we going to be able to do this? And his insights into how to go through the data, he was just so fearless about it. Like, we can do this. And it really was the thing that made it work come together. And he probably knows the data and knows the model as well as anybody in the world. And that was really a cool thing that my son actually was able to do that. I don't say this, who is much smarter than I am. I mean, he is I was just with somebody and he said, oh yeah, your son is really, really smart. And I was like, his brain works faster than mine, and which can be a pain in the ass sometimes, but he is really bright. And to see him play that out was wonderful.
I love that. And then a couple of pages later, you as you do so well in most books, particularly The Advantage. I love the introduction to The Advantage, where you paint two kinds of worlds. And you do very similar within The Working Genius. And in it, you talk about how most teams thrive when they connect people with their geniuses and have people come to work at their fullest. But yet many teams fall short of enabling that to happen. Why do you think that is the case? Why do you think many teams and leaders fail to really connect and bring, you know, the genius out of people?
I honestly think the biggest single reason is they just don't know what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, when we do this for people, I think the real insight is that there are these six different things, which people have never really thought of it this way. And, you know, by the way, we do Myers-Briggs and DISC and all, there's all kinds of tools, but none of them ever really connected right down to the ground of what you like doing.
Yeah.
Like, I'm an ENFP, but until you understand my working genius, you don't know what kind of role to put me in. Okay. So I think the biggest thing is people just don't know. So Ryan, this is really interesting. I had a group of executives. It had to be 2 months after we came up with the model, and this multi-billion-dollar company in the Silicon Valley here, we had the executive team go through the model, and we put together the team map, which shows their whole team. And it was clear that this was a technology company that hadn't really come up with a novel new product in 10 years. And they felt terrible about it. They're like, why aren't we like that? We looked at their geniuses and they had nobody on the team with any of the two geniuses that exist in ideation. None. And they were like, except they had one guy that had the genius of invention, which we'll explain. He was their lawyer. So the guy sitting in the seat of the chief legal counsel actually had a talent for coming up with new ideas and understanding how they fit together. And, you know, they didn't need my coaching. They just looked at it and they said, hey, why don't we move the new technology acquisition department under you? And he was like, but I'm the lawyer. And they're like, yeah, but you have this genius. They reorganized the top of a multi-billion dollar company just because they had no idea when they looked at this. The CEO said, I have none of these talents. We need you thinking about this. 2 years later, I went and looked. The guy's no longer in the law department at all. He's running the technology parts. So I just don't think people know. I think once you know, it's like, oh, wow, we could move some people around or shift your job responsibilities or hire somebody to help you with this.
Yeah.
It's mostly just that we're ignorant of what people's gifts are.
We'll go through some of my profile just for laughs in a minute, but I'd love for a little overview of the six so that listeners can follow us. But one of the things, we both run companies, and my frustrations are in the galvanizing and tenacity, and that will make sense for people in a minute. But there's an element of going, well, that's my job. I still have to do those things. Like how do you balance that dichotomy of like, it's my job, but it's not my genius?
I love it. It's this. Yes, we all have to do things outside of our area of genius. And yes, everyone has to do things sometimes in their area of frustration. But if you have a job that's predominantly focused on that, and I did my first job out of college that I failed at for 2 years, I didn't realize until 30 years later that it was a job organized around my working frustrations. Had I known that, I would have said, thank you for the job offer. I know you're paying a lot of money. Everybody thinks this is a great job, but for me, this would be a horrible job. One man's trash is another man's treasure. I didn't know that. So we should never take a job that's forcing us to lean too hard into our weaknesses. Because the best thing that could happen is we could white knuckle it and get good at those things. And then people could keep asking us to do them. And we're in prison for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
Well, so it's not an go ahead.
I was going to say, it goes a step further in one of the parables is that, particularly of Max, where one of the colleagues says, you end up having to, we have to stop this idea of doing the thing we're not good at so that we get to do the thing that we're good at. We have to stop that idea.
Right. So I'm going to tell you a story. So Meg Whitman is famous. I don't know if you know who she is, but she's the CEO of HP, or she has been for years, and ran eBay and all these other stuff. Well, when I was at Bain, she was the partner and I was the most junior member of the team. And after I survived 2 years, which is what you usually do in those places, but it was not a pleasant 2 years for me, she pulled me aside and she said, Pat, you would be a really good partner, which is essentially what I do now, like help them figure out. She goes, but you're not good at this job here, which is quantifying stuff and doing all this. And that was such a beautiful thing. But the problem was at that firm, they would take the people that were good at the quantifiable stuff and they'd promote them to a partner. And
beyond their competence.
Right. It's a different set of skills.
Yes.
So it's crazy.
We do that in policing all the time. We'd promote people far beyond their competence. But when do you want your best detective to be the chief of the police? You don't, like, because the flow of information only goes down and you're telling people what to do at that point, really, aren't you? But it's powerful.
It's crazy. It doesn't make any sense. It's like saying the best player on the team should end up becoming the coach. Right. Oftentimes the best coaches weren't great players because they didn't have a lot of natural talent and they had to overcome that and figure things out. So it just, you don't do that in sports because you know it doesn't work, but in businesses, we do it all the time.
Yeah. Six geniuses. There are three phases of work. You talk about ideate, activate, implement. Each of those phases have two geniuses. Geniuses, genii, I don't know the plural of geniuses.
You know, it probably is genii. You're the first person to say that. Leave it to a British person.
Yeah.
Correct me on my grammar.
I don't. My wife is sick of the way that I do those things. But so tell us about the six. What are the six headline geniuses? And then humor me by looking at my profile and without knowing me, you and I have had a brief conversation. What can you predict my working life would be like just by seeing my profile?
Okay. So I'm going to start. I'll go fast for people listening to this. We go from the top to the bottom, the beginning to the end, and work flows in this sequence generally, not perfectly, but so we're going to start with the first genius, which is at 50,000 feet up in the clouds. And it's the genius of wonder. And your wife, Lisa, has this. Mm-hmm. And that is the genius of wonder is people who ponder things and they get lost in their thoughts and they're looking at the environment around and they ask questions like, why is it like this? Is this the best way? I wonder if there's a different way to do this. Maybe we should rethink this. They do that naturally. And it is in fact a genius, and every great company, every great product, every great program, anything you do starts with somebody saying, maybe there's a better way. Or in my case, this came about because Amy said to me, why are you like that?
Yes.
She didn't know the answer, but she asked the question. Now, most people that have this as a genius, they're through their whole lives, people have been saying, why are you still asking questions? Get your head out of the clouds. It's like, no, it's a gift. It's a gift. So wonder is the first genius. Yeah. The next one that flows after that is somebody looks at that question and says, I love that question. Let me come up with something. And that's the genius of invention. It's one of my geniuses. Mm-hmm. I love to come up with new ideas out of nothing. I love when somebody comes along and says, you know, what would be great is if there was a better way to do this. And immediately the whiteboard is full of stuff. I'm thinking about it. I'm really comfortable. Other people, if you told them that was their job, like my favorite thing to do in work is another person's misery. You go up and you say, here's a blank whiteboard. Here's a pen. Come up with a new idea. And they're like, why don't you just kill me? Because I hate this. And I'm like, oh, that's the best job in the world. So that's the second one. First, it's wonder, and then it's invention. And that's where new ideas come from.
Yep.
The next one is called discernment. And I love talking about this. This is one of yours. It's one of mine as well. And that is people that can look at something and use their gut feel, their intuition to understand, like, I think this is the best idea. They evaluate things through integrative thinking. It's not through details and data. It's more like they see patterns. And I love to talk about a woman in my office who has discernment. Whenever we make a decision, everybody just says, ask Tracy. And it's not even stuff that she knows a lot about. My wife and I will be like, should we refinance our house? She's like, well, you should probably ask Tracy. Like, should we go on to Greece on vacation? Ask Tracy what she thinks. She's always has some insight, and it's in her gut. And it's not because she's an expert on home financing or traveling to Greece. She's just like, I don't think that sounds like a good idea. Or yeah, that would be a great idea. And when Tracy has discerned it, we have a lot of confidence that it's probably a good idea. That's a gift. That's a gift. Now, the one that follows that is what's called galvanizing.
Yep.
Once the idea has been discerned and we're like, yep, that's a good idea, somebody has to get people excited. Somebody has to rally the troops, pull people together, remind them, give them a little push. Yeah. Say, hey, everybody, let's do this. Who's in? And some people wake up in the morning. You're not one of them. In fact, this is one of your least favorite things and says, please make me get up in front of people and get them to do something they don't want to do.
Yeah, that's not me.
And you're like, oh, I would hate that. I was doing it every day in my company and it wasn't my genius. And I was burned out after 20 years. I'd come to work wanting to I and D, invent and discern. And everybody was like, come on, galvanize us, galvanize us, galvanize us. And I would just start getting frustrated.
Yeah. Now, well, this is what it's like when Team Hartley are trying to leave the house, get on time for school in the morning, or try and be somewhere where we said we'll be there at a certain time. I don't like it, but we're going to be late. And obviously, Mrs. Hartley is just like, I don't like this version of you. And I'm like, I don't like being this version of me either.
Right. So my wife, I think, has the same two working frustrations as you do. So your lowest level is the same as you. And she just motivating the kids to get something done. It's either she doesn't do it or she's nagging them. And she says, I don't want to be a nag. And I'm like, but people that have a genius of galvanizing, they're like, no, I'll make it fun.
Yeah.
And she's just like, oh, I hate having to do this. Let me tell you, my wife, I leave for church. I leave separately. I get there for 10 minutes and her and my son come. I have one son left at home still. And they're inevitably late, both of them. And it's probably my wife's fault more than my son. So I don't even do it anymore. I just leave and I say, I'll see you there.
Yeah. That's so funny.
So we just went through the first two, wonder and invention, ideation, and then discernment and galvanizing. That's where we evaluate the idea and then get people excited.
Yeah.
That's activation. The last two are implementation. And the first genius there is called, it's called enablement, enabling people, which is a good thing. It's not enablement around drugs and alcohol. It's enabling somebody, lifting them up to get things started and coming alongside and helping them. It is an absolute genius. It's so important. And yet people think, oh, I'm just nice. I just volunteer a lot. No, there are people in the world, and I'm not one of them. You are. That when somebody says, I need help, you actually go, oh, good.
Yeah.
How can I help you?
Let me stop what I'm doing and I'll help you.
Right. Now, I feel really guilty that I'm not. Your wife is not one of these either. And that doesn't mean she's not a kind person. It means she doesn't naturally get joy and energy out of being interrupted and doing what another person wants them to do. But you actually don't find that to be, you're like, yeah, I'd love to do that.
Yeah, until I have to then look at my task list of the things I need to do and I've not done them.
Well, and you know something? And if you're in your marriage, your wife should look at that and go, yeah, Ryan is not naturally going to cross everything off his list. Ooh. Because he is, you are what's called the insightful collaborator. Mm-hmm. When people come along and ask you for advice, you put down your stuff, you give them advice, you help them, you get them started, and that's your genius. Mm. And yes, things are going to fall off your to-do list. Mm. Whereas she, on the other hand, the to-do list is the first thing she's thinking about. And now, rather than getting frustrated at you, she can just say, hey, I know this is not easy for you. Can we go over your to-do list just to make sure that you can get it done? But I know that's not your genius, and I'm not telling you you're a bad person.
Yeah.
I'm just going to help you in that.
And the thing I've had to surrender from her is when she is wondering about, you know, the home improvement things that I would rather not be listening to, that I have to surrender that that's followed up with a solution.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, let's get to that. Let me go through the last one.
Great.
And I love talking about this. So the last one after enablement is tenacity. It's one thing to help people. It's another thing to finish something. So you like the helping part, but not the finishing part.
Yep.
I don't like the finishing part either. Yet there are people, and Lisa is one of them, who wakes up every day and loves to get crap done, loves mm-hmm. to cross it off the list, sees an obstacle, loves to plow through it and say, yes, I did it. It met the target. We got it done. So those are the six types of working genius: wonder, invention, discernment, galvanizing, enablement, tenacity. Now, Lisa has a very interesting combination. She's got the first one, which is the genius of wonder. Mm-hmm. Her head is up there in the clouds at 50,000 feet. And then she has the genius of tenacity, which is 5 feet off the ground. That's a really tough thing because there's like altitude sickness brought in there. She's up like, I wonder if we should buy a new house. Oh my gosh, we got to pay the bills. So it's really hard for people. She has the furthest apart working geniuses. Mm. She's on both extremes, way up in the clouds and way down on the ground. And that can cause a lot of internal stress because she's going from, I got to get this done, but I got to ponder it more. Mm. And it's a really important thing to understand because I know people that are WTs or TWs, and it can be really hard to know. And what I always tell them is separate those things. Mm. Give yourself time to W and crush the T to stop worrying about that. And then when you're T-ing something, when you're finishing something, tenacity, try to park your W because it'll keep interrupting you and calling you to reconsider everything.
Come back up higher. Yeah. That's really powerful. Great insights. I love that. I look forward to sharing that with her.
Now, you're the discerning enablement person, which is the insightful collaborator. You are the consummate team player advisor, the person that if you go to them and ask them for help, they say yes, but let me tell you what I think you might need some help in another area too. It's like, would you help me with this? Yes, I will. But have you also thought of this?
Have you considered? Yeah.
So that's what you are. But what you're not is a command and control, get things done. I'm going to kick your ass if you don't finish this.
It's interesting when you said earlier at the very start, which is like this is like the flow of work. It's not always ideal. Well, my flow of work is that I start, I get to the middle bit, and then I probably start something new before I get to the tenacity and finishing.
Exactly. Because you're in your working competencies, you do have wonder and invention too. So you are a, you know, but the G and the T is the person that gets the whip out and says, okay, people, nobody's going home until we finish this. And that is the last thing you want to do.
Well, you know, I've been dancing with these profiles for a couple of weeks, and I can already see how it's going to make so much possible. And I think one of the things that you kind of said earlier, which is, I think these profiles just make grace possible. I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. My wife and I, okay, I'll tell you our profiles. I mean, neither of us have tenacity. Mm. It's in our working frustration. So Lisa has it first, tenacity. Mm-hmm. You have it last. Okay, so one of you loves to get stuff done. The other one is like, please don't make me finish anything. Okay, let me move on to the next thing. Okay, my wife and I both have it last. Neither of us like to do it. So one day I came home from work, and this is before we did Working Genius. And I walked in the house and I turned on the lights and they didn't go on. I said, hey, Laura, the power's out in our neighborhood, you know, because that's usually what it is. She goes, nope, it's not out in the neighborhood. I looked outside. Oh, you're right. The neighbors have power. Oh, well, we must have blown a fuse because our power's out. She goes, no, we did not blow a fuse. And I'm like, well, the power's out. She goes, yep. I said, what happened? She goes, they cut off our power. And I said, what? She goes, yeah, I didn't pay the bill. And I said, oh, wow. Don't they usually send you a notice before they cut it out? She goes, oh, no, they send you three notices. And they're around here somewhere. And I remember at the time thinking, how could you not? I wasn't giving her grace. I'm like, well, you pay the bills. How could you do that? Yeah. And now I know her working genius. And it's not an excuse to say, well, we're not going to have power. It's a way for me to go, man, you do a job here at our house that I hate and you hate.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And yeah, we probably need to figure out how to not let this happen again. But darn it, you're amazing. And this is actually predictable, understanding what we don't do well.
Yeah, my wife and I've been together 21 years. It's only been in the last few years that we've kind of slowly surrendered to the fact that some of us are good at stuff, and some of us are.
Exactly.
We needed, and now you know what it is. At the point we got married, Patrick, we needed, you know,
right?
Reading the bands and taking our profile.
I think everyone who gets married should look at this, because it'll avoid them judging one another.
Yes.
Because I used to kind of think, and I'm not proud of this, but like, gosh, Laura, you're lazy. I mean, you got to pay the bills. They come in, you got to do them. And I'm right in that she has to do them, but I'm wrong to think she's lazy. It's just really hard for her to stay on top of it day in and day out. Now, Lisa would have no problem doing that. Mm-hmm. Like, your power will never be out. No thanks to you, Ryan, but because of Lisa, that will never happen.
Well, the pain that I suffered would be that her perception would be that would be my job. Therefore, she would project the tenacity onto me and judge me for not being that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we literally, things happen in our house now. And we laugh together. We go, look at who we are. This is just who we are. That's okay.
You talk about in the book how it's not just like a personality, it's a productivity tool. And I know maybe we can talk about some of the productivity elements within a team, but I also think it's a possibility tool. One of the greatest insights that I got when I became a father and a manager at the same time in the police, I was mid-20s. I became a father and I became a manager for the first time. I started to realize my impact as a manager leader on my team and my people. I had the impact to send them home better to the children they had and the people that they were, you know, irreplaceable to. And I think that's what these profiles make possible, is that when a workplace brings you in and brings in the framework to their organization, it's not just going to make their workforce more productive, it's going to open up possibilities for the family, for the communities, because these insights, they're life-giving.
Yeah. And I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if that weren't the case. I mean, I love helping companies get more productive. I do. But if I didn't think it translated over into every aspect of their lives, it would be a lot less interesting to me. My dad, when I was a kid, used to come home from work, and he was a good dad, really good dad, God rest his soul. And he was a good salesman. But he came home and complained about management at his company all the time. And he was really frustrated.
Yeah.
He brought that home. I didn't know what management was, but I thought, this is stupid. Well, what I realized was, if you have a healthy work environment, and a big part of that is if your manager and your colleagues know what you're great at,
yeah,
and they're celebrating that.
Yeah,
you go home at night and you treat your spouse and your kids and your new dog so much better, and you're kinder to people on the bus or in the neighborhood. But when people are frustrated at work and when they don't feel like people understand their genius and who they are, really bad things happen.
Yeah,
and I think that the purpose of work is to give us dignity and fulfillment so that we can be better people. And I think that the fact that serves productivity and it serves the individual is a wonderful overlap.
Yeah. Some of the worst people for being terribly humble and in inverted commas, probably denying of their genius are people in the church. You know, they could be so cut off maybe from the genius that they have within them. Maybe even would say, well, I don't have any genius, but you're quite adamant. You're quite adamant. This is God-given genius. What gives you such a conviction?
Well, first of all, because what we found is that people have these from the time they're young.
Yeah.
Sometimes they weren't recognized. Oftentimes they weren't recognized, but they look back and they go, oh, yeah, I've always been like that. I just didn't know it was actually okay to be that way.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, you said something before that I wanted to say about, oh, yeah, in church, we have a misplaced understanding of humility.
Yeah.
And C.S. Lewis has a great definition of humility, and that's humility is not thinking less of yourself than you should. It's thinking about yourself less.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you work in a church and you're really good at singing, or you're really good at counseling, or you're really good at giving a talk, or you're really good at whatever, to deny that, like, oh, I'm not that good at that, actually, that's kind of offensive to the guy who gave you the gift.
Right. Yeah.
Right? Because you're not bragging about yourself. You're bragging. If somebody gives you a gift, if I came up and gave you a car, and somebody said, that's a great car, you'd go, can you believe Pat gave me this car?
Yeah, yeah.
You wouldn't go, oh, it's not that good of a car. But if you think that you're being selfish by acknowledging your gifts,
yeah,
then you're going to say, well, I'm not really that good at it. Similarly, when you didn't get a gift and somebody goes, hey, you really stink at that, you should go, I know. Can you believe God didn't give me any gifts in that area? It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
It's not an excuse, but at least you can celebrate that and let other people know, yeah, I'm pretty bad at that.
Yeah.
So I'll do my best, but if you're going to give me some help or some advice, I'd love to take it. So oftentimes people that can't celebrate their strengths are the very ones that deny their weaknesses too.
Yeah, I think in the book of Peter, it talks about how the gifts, we're supposed to use them. You know, the gifts, they're not necessarily for us, but we're supposed to use them, serve them with them, and not necessarily give them away as if it's like a martyr free, but contribute. And I think that just makes joy, fulfillment, just so much more of a richer experience.
Yeah, no doubt. And you said at the beginning, like, why did you keep writing and work? You could have, what did you call it?
You could have continued to dine out on your old books, you know, live a nice life.
Dine out on it. I love that. Yeah. And the thing is, you know, my genius is invention and discernment.
Yeah.
So I love doing this.
Yes.
And I love that other people benefit from it. But if I had different geniuses, I might, let's just say I came up with that book and my geniuses were really, you know, WI or ET. I might have said, okay, I'm going to dine out on this and I'm going to go do something that allows me to implement things.
Which makes it more of an expression of who you are then rather than the work that you're doing.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's its own gift, that I get to use the gifts that make me joyful and that people benefit from that. It's like, I should be very grateful, and I am.
Yeah. What are you seeing within the community? Because I know you've got loads of trainers going out into organizations. You know, what are some of the things that you're hearing back from the impact of the Working Genius as it's continuing to be rolled out? What different sectors, like, what are some of the real stories that are taking your heart, you know, taking your breath?
People that used to feel, they used to look at themselves with guilt, and they used to look at people on their team with judgment, unfair judgment. There's a place for guilt and judgment in the world, but not in that way.
Mm.
And they're like turning that into appreciation and celebration. They're like, wow, you're really, that's really cool that you're good at that. It's okay that you're not good at that. I like doing that. I'll do that for you. And you could do this for me. It's just changing. It's bringing joy instead of guilt and judgment. That's the biggest one I'm finding.
Well, it's just transformational, isn't it? Because if we think about those possibilities, you know, we talk about the story of Max in the book where, you know, you've got this young employee that's maybe not a fit, but, or he's certainly a cultural fit, but he's not, you know, meeting the kind of performance requirements of the role. And just one discussion about genius completely changes the performance within the organization. And how you talk about how the CEO within the book is not, you know, a genius at the galvanizing, but there's someone else is like, oh, you're kidding? I'd love to get involved in some of that stuff. And this stuff's already there. It's lying dormant within teams. It just needs untapping.
And that's where the productivity thing comes in. Because productivity is one of those words that sounds like something you measure, efficiency in a factory. But here's what it looks like. So for years, I was coming to work excited to invent and discern, and yet I was getting dragged into galvanizing. Now, as the CEO of my own firm, do I have to galvanize? Yes. Do I have to be the chief galvanizing officer every day? No. I found a guy in my company who had galvanizing as a genius. I said, why don't you be the chief galvanizing officer? He now is love. And he was like, I'm too young. I don't have the right. And I said, no, it's not about how old you are. It's about you have a gift. So he is now doing something he loves. I'm doing less of what I don't love. And we're getting more done in less time than we did before. Because when you move people and align them a little bit more with their, or a lot more with their geniuses, the output of work and the joy of doing it goes up. I want to give people an analogy, which I haven't said yet today. When you think about the difference between your working genius, your working competency, and your working frustration, I want you to imagine a cup of coffee. And your working genius is like one of those mugs. What do you call those? Like a Yeti mug, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Where you pour coffee into it and you screw the lid on tight.
Yeah.
That will hold the heat of that coffee for 8 hours. You can go back and open it up later and burn yourself. You're like, how did that do that? Because that's your working genius. I can do this kind of stuff forever. Your working competency is your typical coffee cup that you get at Starbucks or wherever else, and you put the plastic lid on it, it'll keep it warm for a while.
Yeah.
Your working frustration is pouring coffee into a cup that has a hole in the bottom of it, and it just starts draining out. Boy, we should know what the difference between those three things and understanding, and we can go to work. Here's one of my favorite stories, Ryan. A guy was going to get a performance review, and it was really bad. He knew it. The night before the review, he did his working genius. And he was like, whoa, this is interesting. So he went and sat down with his boss and said, I know you're about to do my review. Can you look at this, though? He looked at his profile and said, well, no wonder you're doing so bad. We have you in the wrong job.
Yeah.
And he goes, I know. And he goes, we have a different job over here that you'd be really good at. And the guy wrote to us. And he said, I got promoted.
Come on.
Because they looked at my genius and put me into a role where I could be successful. And that, what is that worth? On human terms, in economic terms, they would have fired him. And for the wrong reason, they just had him in the wrong job. So I love that.
So a friend of mine, Jason, he's currently in Fort Worth in Texas. And he today is going through the certification for the Working Genius Model.
No way.
Yeah, so he's going through that today. He's on a 2-day training course today and tomorrow. And so he's in corporate America. And I don't know if this is your experience, but so often it will be the, shall we say, the lower ranking people that will really resonate. That will go, I would love for this to be my working environment. They're almost the early adopters of the environment. And maybe some of the hierarchy, maybe there are some kind of executives and that will be really kind of at a heart level. They get this, but I imagine more often than not, it's the people who work in these environments that only wish the environment you describe is possible for them. How do we bridge the gap? How do we engage the hearts and minds of executives, of HR, and start to bring more of this into the world?
You know, so it's a good question. And if you think about it, that younger person or that lower level person, you know, there's this Stephen Covey, this author, God rest his soul. He came up with the idea called your circle of influence and your circle of concern. And so share it with the people around you. Yeah. Share it with the one, your boss.
Yes.
And what happens in organizations is eventually, this happened recently. I was at a big university and the day before I gave a talk to 200 people, mid-level and some even lower level in the organization. And I had a meeting the next day with the CEO or the next week. And as a result of all those people seeing it, one of the people in that room went to the CEO and said, you should do this. And the next week I did it with them. So don't be surprised that you can take a risk and go, hey, this thing costs $25, right?
Today. Yeah.
And it's like, I'm going to buy a version and send it to my boss or my boss's boss and say, hey, I thought you might like this. It takes 12 minutes to fill it out.
Yeah.
You're going to be their hero. They're going to go, this is great. How do we do this? So take a risk.
It's the model of Jesus, isn't it? It's to the influence and lead just by being. By being about it, being excited about it, showing that it works, you know, being the light. And then people will follow because they can see the impact.
And share, even if you get rejected. You know, I mean, he said, hey, if you go to that town and they don't receive you, you know, move on, shake the dust off your feet. But sometimes we're like, I'm not going to share something unless I know they're going to want it. And then we'll never share things because it's like, and that gets back to getting naked, you know?
Yeah.
Don't be afraid of somebody going, yeah, I think this is stupid. Go, okay, moving along.
Does this work deep in your faith?
Does this tool, say again?
Does this body of work deepen your faith?
Oh, does it deepen my faith? Yeah, because I realize that, I mean, for me, I'm doing some work on wounds right now. when you grow up and people don't see you for who you are, and it's especially true of your parents, and they just don't really see you, because that's what we want to do, is we want to be seen and known and made to feel safe in who we are.
Yeah.
It's hard to know God's love when you don't have that when you're young.
Yeah.
And so if we can look back and go, oh, wow, that I was this little kid who loved these things. That was a gift I had. I never knew that. Oh, I can now I have a little bit more context for kind of who got looked up, missed, passed over when he was a kid.
Yeah, we were fortunate enough to have John Eldridge on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. And John is the author of Wild at Heart, Many Christian Men book. And just when you talk about wounds, one of the things that has really kind of captured my heart over the last few years is the Paul's scripture of the thorns in the flesh, right? It's literal wound, right? So in the Passion Translation, I've never seen this response. In the Passion Translation, God's response to Paul after pleading three times to remove the thorns for his flesh, he says, "In your weakness, you will find my fullest expression." And that's just like, oh, come on. Like,
the cross.
Right. In those wounds, you will find God's fullest expression.
Somebody, I heard somebody refer the other day to your cross is a veiled throne. So to take away the cross, that becomes the throne. And so, yeah, we're always like, can you take this away? And, you know, we never found out what his thorn was, did we?
No.
We don't know what it was, but we all have them. But the difference is, if we blame ourselves for the thorn or we despair about the thorn, the devil wins.
Right.
Paul also said, this is something Paul also said, and I do this thing where I'm a Catholic. I read the readings every morning on this app. Then at the end of it, it always says this. Paul said, rejoice always, pray without ceasing, and be thankful in all circumstances, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you. So even the thorn, we're supposed to go, ouch.
Right.
Thank you, God. There's a reason for that.
Whilst in the lion's den, thank you for this experience.
Right.
Yes.
And so that's so countercultural, and I want it. I want to say, God, thank you for this difficulty.
And looping it back to then the frustrations, it's not wishing they were anything other. It's acceptance.
Exactly. Thank you for humbling me and not giving me these geniuses. I need others.
Yes, 100%. It sets the context, doesn't it? Is there anything about your body of work that I've not made space for today that you'd love to share?
No, you've done a great job. I can't think of anything else I'd want you to talk about. That's I mean, we could talk for 4 hours, but you did a great... Your curiosity and passion for this has really brought things out. It's great.
I appreciate that. I appreciate it. I have a word here, always better than yesterday. It's called heartprint. And the word really symbolizes the ripple effect and the possibilities that we create in the lives of other people. And Pat, I just wonder if you just take a moment, and maybe you'll do this specifically with Working Genius, or maybe your work in general. But, you know, you come to the end of your career, end of your days. What do you hope your heartprint will be?
Oh, just that people will come to know Jesus through me. That's it. The end of the day. That's what I want. And whether it's that I'm sharing him with them directly or they see it reflected in other things I do, that's, you know, that's what I want. And I want, and that's what I want.
How can people take their assessment?
You can go to workinggenius.com, which is a website, workinggenius.com, two G's in the middle there. And you, it's all easy to do right there. Click on that. We're coming out with a student version too, because a lot of people said, I want to know what my kids are when they're teenagers.
Yes. Come on.
So we're just about to launch that as well. But right now you can go on there. You can do it in Spanish. You can all different kinds, because, you know, there's a lot of Spanish speaking people in the UK. So,
yeah. Pat, grateful for your grateful for your energy. I could just feel your passion for this. I absolutely encourage everybody to go and check out your work and your books. I frequently share them on this podcast already, specifically The Working Genius. Go get your profile. Pat, we'll be honored if you'd leave us a final thought from your good self.
Oh, I mean, gosh, the final thoughts you just had, it's like, it's Lent season, we say right now, leading up to Easter. And know that even in the midst of suffering, there is goodness. You know, even in the midst of suffering, my wife is a convert, and she was like, what's the deal with suffering? Why do you guys talk about that? And she's like, oh, now I get it. Life involves suffering. No one escapes it. And even in that, we can receive good things.
God's yes. Thing. I know what it's like to have nothing, and I know what it's like to have plenty, and it's grateful in all circumstances.
Exactly.
Yeah, I appreciate it, brother. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. God bless you.
Hey, my friends, thank you for making it to the end. I hope that our time spent together today has left you a little bit better than before you push play. I'd really appreciate if you just took a moment to leave a review to allow me to meet more people where they are and hopefully leave them a little bit better too. If you're curious to know how I, through Always Better Than Yesterday, can serve you, your team, your organization, then head to alwaysbetterthanyesterday.com to connect. And while you're there, let me know one or two things that you're going to do as a result of listening to this conversation. I absolutely love hearing your thoughts, your reflections, and the things that this spark in your own heart and mind. If you want more insights from my heart and mind, I do send out short episodes on a Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. And again, I hope that they serve you well. I appreciate you listening. I'm Ryan Hartley, host of the Always Better Than Yesterday podcast, a podcast for heart-centered leaders just like you. Keep leading, my friends. Always love.